All right, welcome to the deep dive. Today we're going to be looking at, well, honestly, something pretty crucial. You know how we always talk about the science behind the medicines we take? Well, this time we're going deeper. We're diving into the world of drug formulation, but with a twist. We're focusing on all those regulations, all those rules that actually dictate how these medicines are made.
It's like, we often get fascinated by the breakthroughs in research and the clever chemistry behind new drugs, but there's this whole other side to the story. And that's what we're exploring in this deep dive. Like, how do those regulations, those frameworks, actually end up shaping the blueprint of a medicine? You know, how it's made, the steps involved, the quality checks, everything. It's a whole hidden world almost.
It really is, and it's fascinating stuff. We've got a bunch of sources lined up for this, looking at the paperwork involved, the whole scientific basis of formulation, and even the real-world challenges of actually getting a drug approved.
Yeah, like navigating that approval maze, it's a story in itself.
Yeah, for sure. So, for everyone listening, today's mission, if you choose to accept it, is to really grasp those forces at play behind the scenes, The regulatory forces that are shaping the medicines we all rely on. We want to make this whole complex area a little bit clearer without getting too bogged down in all the super technical
Right,
stuff.
cutting through the jargon.
Exactly. Okay, so where do we even start with this? Let's talk about the foundation, the bedrock. Documentation and compliance. This term kept popping up in our research. Drug master file or DMF. What exactly is that and why should we care?
So a DMF, it's basically like, imagine a really detailed confidential document.
Okay.
You submit it to the FDA and it contains like everything you need to know about the facilities, the processes, the materials, everything involved in making, processing, packaging, even storing a drug product.
Okay, so it's like the ultimate recipe book for a medicine.
In a way, yeah.
Cool.
But here's the thing. Submitting a DMF, it's not actually mandatory.
Yeah.
It's totally voluntary on the part of the company, the holder, whatever you want to call them.
So they choose to share all this sensitive info. Seems a bit counterintuitive.
It might seem that way, but think of it like this. This voluntary submission, it actually ends up smoothing out the whole approval process later on. So companies can reference this detailed information, this DMF, across multiple drug applications. And that saves everyone a lot of time and hassle. It's a strategic move, boosts efficiency for both the company and the regulators.
So they kind of front load the info to make things easier down the road.
Exactly. They're saying, here's all the background, the nitty-gritty up front. So when it comes to the actual applications, like for a new drug, a generic drug, or even just to start clinical trials, the main application has this solid foundation to build on. Regulators can easily access all the key details without needing everything resubmitted every single time.
Gotcha. So it's all about streamlining.
Yeah, but here's a key point. The DMF itself, it doesn't actually grant any approval. It's purely there as supporting documentation.
Like, it's not the golden ticket, but it definitely helps pave the way.
Precisely.
Okay, makes sense. Now, switching gears a bit, another big piece of this whole compliance puzzle seems to be production records. We kept seeing CFR 211.192 mentioned in our research. Can you shed some light on that one?
Sure. So CFR, it stands for Code of Federal Regulations, basically the rule book from the U.S. government. And Part 211.192, that's the section that lays out this very specific requirement.
Okay, hit me with it.
It says that before any batch of a drug can be released, sent out into the world, the quality control unit has to go over every single production and control record. And I mean, everything from the raw materials they started with all the way to the final packaging and labeling. Every step has to be checked and signed off on.
Wow, talk about attention to detail.
It's serious business. And there's more. This work gets really interesting. If there's any discrepancy, anything that seems off, or if a batch doesn't meet the preset quality standards, it triggers a full-blown investigation.
And I'm guessing they don't just look at that one batch, right?
Nope. The regulation's super clear on that. The investigation has to extend to other batches of the same drug, and even to other products that might have been affected by whatever the issue was.
Wow, so one little hiccup can have huge ripple effects.
Yeah, it really shows you how interconnected everything is in drug manufacturing. It's not just about isolating one bad batch, it's about understanding if there's a systemic problem somewhere.
Makes you realize how important those investigations are.
Definitely. And of course, all of it has to be documented, every single step, the findings, the conclusions, the actions they took to fix the problem. It's all about transparency and accountability.
So we've talked about the importance of documentation, the strictness of compliance. Now let's shift focus a bit. how do all these regulations actually influence the product itself, the formulation, the design? Our sources kept mentioning something called quality by design, or QBD. What's that all about?
QBD. It's kind of a revolution in how we approach drug development. It's this systematic, science-based approach where you start by setting very clear quality goals for your product.
Okay, so like, what are we aiming for with this medicine?
Exactly. And then the real work begins. QBD is all about truly understanding both the drug itself and the process used to make it. You have to pinpoint those critical product attributes and the process parameters, the things that can really affect the quality.
So figuring out what makes it tick and what can mess it up.
Exactly. And the ultimate goal is to create what we call a design space. Think of it like a safe zone for your manufacturing process.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you stay within those boundaries, you know your drug is going to be good. And of course, you need a solid control strategy to make sure you stay in that safe zone consistently.
Okay, I'm following. So why are regulators so keen on this QBD approach?
Because it's proactive. Instead of just testing the final product and hoping for the best, you're building quality into the entire process from the get-go. It's like having a safety net woven into every step. And that shift, that focus on the whole product lifecycle, that's really changing the regulatory landscape.
Makes sense. So it's not just about checking boxes at the end. It's about understanding the why behind everything.
Absolutely. And that understanding, it's not static. It keeps evolving as you learn more throughout development. You use risk management, scientific knowledge, all of it to make sure you're consistently hitting that target of acceptable quality.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned this concept of a control strategy. How does something like process analytical technology, or PT, fit into that?
Ah, PT. That's where the real-time magic happens.
Okay, tell me more.
It's a system of, like, tools and strategies to measure the really important quality attributes, not just of the final product, but also the raw materials, the stuff in the middle of processing, everything. The idea is to monitor and ideally control the manufacturing process as it's happening.
So like having eyes on everything all the time.
Exactly. It's like having sensors and feedback loops built right into the manufacturing line.
High-tech stuff.
Oh, yeah. And it's perfect for QBD because it gives you that real-time data, the analytical power you need to really understand and control the process.
So QBD sets the goals and PT helps you stay on track.
You got it. Now let's talk about a specific type of formulation that often faces, like, extra scrutiny from regulators.
Mm-hmm.
Injectables.
Oh, yeah. Those are the high-stakes ones.
For sure. Our sources mentioned that there are often serious limitations on what you can use in injectables, specifically the excipients, the inactive ingredients, you know, the stuff that's not the actual drug itself.
Why is that?
Well, think about it. With injectables, you're bypassing a lot of the body's natural defenses. You're going straight into the bloodstream or tissues. So that the bar for sterility, purity, overall safety, it's all set way higher. Those excipients, they have to be super well tolerated. They can't cause any bad reactions.
Makes sense. So where do they even find these special excipients?
The FDA has this database, the inactive ingredients database. It's like a big library of all the inactive ingredients that have been used in approved drugs. But here's the catch. Most of those are for oral or topical medications. The list for injectables is much, much shorter.
Yeah.
Our sources pointed out that only a handful of new excipients have actually been developed specifically for injectables. They mentioned a few examples like Captisol, Silitol HS, polyanhydrides.
That does seem pretty limited, especially when you consider all the new complex drugs out there like biologics, proteins, or even small molecules that don't dissolve well in water.
You're hitting on a major challenge in the field. Finding new, safe, and effective excipients for injectables, it's a huge area of research. We need new tools to deliver these more challenging drug molecules. And it's not just about chemistry. It's about bringing together experts from different areas. You know, drug delivery, toxicology, parenteral science.
So it's like a multidisciplinary puzzle they're trying to solve.
Exactly. And here's another layer to that puzzle, packaging.
Wait, packaging too?
Yep. Our sources mentioned that even packaging is getting the QBD treatment these days.
How so?
Well, think about it. The packaging's in direct contact with the drug, sometimes for a long time. So it can definitely impact the quality of the medicine. And regulations are catching up to that. They're saying that packaging materials can't mess with the drug, can't leach harmful substances into it, can't affect its stability. It all ties back to that concept of the quality target product profile, or QTPP, you know, defining the desired quality characteristics of the drug product.
So applying QBD to packaging, how does that work in practice?
It's about understanding how the packaging material behaves.
Mm.
Like, how permeable is it to gases, moisture? How will it affect the drug over time? By testing the drug under different conditions and different packaging configurations, you can really assess the impact of the packaging and make smart choices.
Fascinating. So it's not just a container anymore, it's part of the whole quality system.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's move on to another crucial step. Making sure the manufacturing process itself is reliable and consistently churns out high-quality product. Our sources talk about validation protocols, specifically at stage two. What's the main goal there?
Stage two is all about proving that the manufacturing process, the one they've designed and tested in the lab, actually works in the real world on a commercial scale.
Right.
It's about making sure they can consistently produce high-quality medicine every single time.
High stakes, for sure.
Yeah, and they break this stage down into two parts, stage 2A and stage 2B.
Okay, what's the difference?
So 2A is all about making sure the infrastructure is ready for commercial production.
Yeah.
That means qualifying the equipment, you know, making sure it's installed, calibrated, working properly. It's about the utilities, the water, the air systems, and even the facility itself, the design, the layout, everything. It's like a big checklist to make sure everything's in place and up to snuff.
Got it. And 2B?
2B is where they actually assess the manufacturing process itself,
right.
But they do it in a setting that mimics real-world commercial production.
So like a dress rehearsal.
Exactly. They do a bunch of runs, making batches of the drug under normal operating conditions, collecting tons of data.
And that data is the key, right? That's how they prove consistency.
You got it. That data is gold. They analyze it statistically to show that the process, when run within the defined parameters, consistently produces medicine that meets all the quality standards. That's the justification for using that process in the real world.
So it's a really data-driven approach. They're not just saying, trust us, it works. They're showing the evidence.
Exactly. It's all about transparency and scientific rigor.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit and talk about real-world examples of navigating this regulatory maze. Our sources briefly mentioned the development of anti-cancer drugs. Is there anything unique about the regulatory process for those kinds of medicines?
Yeah, definitely. Anti-cancer drugs, especially the newer molecularly targeted therapies, they often present unique challenges. You're dealing with serious life-threatening diseases, so there's often a higher risk tolerance from both patients and regulators. They want to get these promising new treatments into clinical trials faster, even if there's still some uncertainty.
So the urgency of the situation kind of changes the equation.
Exactly. And that can influence the timeline of preclinical testing, the types of studies they do, all of that. They're always weighing the potential benefits against the risks. And with cancer, the stakes are obviously very high.
Makes sense. Now, another concept that came up in our research was bioequivalence. What exactly is that, and why is it so important from a regulatory standpoint, especially for generic drugs?
Bioequivalence, it's all about making sure that a generic drug works in the body the same way as the original brand name drug. It's about comparing how much of the active ingredient gets absorbed into the bloodstream, how fast it gets there, all of that.
So it's not just about having the same ingredients, it's about how your body actually uses them.
Exactly. And the FDA has specific regulations, like those in CFR Title 21, Part 314, that require generic drug makers to prove that their product is bioequivalent to the original. This ensures that the generic version will have the same therapeutic effect and safety profile.
So if you switch to a generic, you can be confident you're getting the same benefit.
That's the goal. Now, there are some situations where the FDA might waive the need for in vivo bioequivalence studies, meaning studies in living organisms.
Oh, really? When does that happen?
Well, CFR Part 320 outlines specific criteria for waivers. Like, for example, with certain oral solutions where you know the absorption is going to be rapid and complete, they might not require full-blown human studies.
Interesting. So they're not just blindly applying the rules, they're using scientific knowledge to make informed decisions.
Absolutely. It's all about striking that balance between rigor and flexibility.
Now, one last big topic, global regulatory expectations. With drug development and manufacturing becoming increasingly globalized, what are some of the challenges that companies face in trying to meet all the different requirements around the world?
Oh, that's a huge one. It adds a whole other layer of complexity. You have different regulatory agencies in different countries, each with their own sets of rules and expectations. A company might have to tweak their manufacturing process, provide additional data, even change their testing methods, all to satisfy the requirements of different regions.
Sounds like a logistical nightmare.
It can be. You've got the FDA in the US, the EMA in Europe, and then there's the International Council for Harmonization, or ICH, which tries to harmonize regulations globally. But even with harmonization, there are still variations and nuances. It can make things really tricky for companies trying to launch a drug in multiple markets simultaneously.
Makes you appreciate the global nature of this whole enterprise.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so to wrap things up, let's bring it back to the heart of the matter. Patient safety. How do all these robust formulation standards, all these regulations we've been talking about, actually translate to safer and more effective medicines for patients?
Well, think of those standards as the foundation of everything. They ensure that the medicines we take are consistently high quality, that they work as intended, and that they minimize any potential for harm. Regulations cover every step, from the purity of the ingredients to the stability of the final product. They mandate things like preclinical ADME studies, which look at how the drug is absorbed, distributed, metabolized, and excreted in the body. This helps identify any potential safety issues early on.
And they also look at things like potential effects on the heart.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one. They have to test for HERG channel inhibition, which can cause serious heart rhythm problems. Catching that early is crucial.
Wow. So it really is a multifaceted system designed to protect patients.
It is. And preclinical PK/PD modeling, that's another important tool. It helps understand the relationship between the drug concentration in the body and its effects, which can inform dosing and help predict potential side effects.
So it's about understanding not just what the drug does, but how it does it.
Exactly. And all of this, from the initial design of the formulation to the ongoing monitoring of its effects, it all contributes to ensuring that the medicines we rely on are both effective and as safe as possible.
It's really impressive when you think about all the layers of oversight involved.
It is. Drug formulation is a heavily regulated field, and for good reason. Every decision, from the choice of an excipient to the validation of a manufacturing process, it's all scrutinized to ensure patient safety and product quality. Understanding these regulatory aspects, it gives you a new appreciation for the journey of a medicine from the lab to the pharmacy shelf.
It really does. So a final thought for our listeners today. We've talked about the complexity of global regulations, the constant push for harmonization. How do you think these efforts will continue to shape the availability and affordability of medicines around the world? It's a big question with huge implications for global health, something worth pondering as you go about your day. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Thanks for having me.
It was great having you.